the tradition of meditation practice, which I have practiced and studied in mostly and have adapted these teachings from, is a tradition out of Burma that was initiated and started by a Burmese monk in the last century called Mahasi Sayadaw. And he has written many books, and one of them is called A Manual of Insight. And he says that the purpose of insight meditation is this. It is to understand nama-rupa. That means to understand the nature of the body and the nature of the mind and their relationship to one another. Secondly, it is to see the three characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the impersonality of experience. And fourthly, or thirdly, the benefit or the practice of the benefit of the practice of insight meditation is to realize the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is the kind of the bedrock of the Buddha's teaching, which posits as the goal of our spiritual practice, or this practice, liberation. Freedom from suffering of all kinds, of any kind, no matter how gross or how subtle, freedom from that. And I think that the way we have kind of transmitted the teachings of the Buddha to the West is good, and it is accomplishing a lot of that. But I think, and I'll just get your opinion on this too, but I think there is an easy recognition and a valuing of meditation practice or awareness practice for what I would call coming to accept ourselves and to enhance the quality of life that we're living. And I think those of us who've been practicing for some time, and I think those of you who are new to practice but aspire to practice for some time, have as some level of goal or aspiration feeling better about ourselves and being able to live in greater harmony within and without, with each other. And all that is very noble. And that is very, it's kind of confirmed even with a little practice. Just getting a handle on managing stressful conditions, which we all live with, is a great relief. And it improves our sense of well-being in the world. And if we practice in addition to that, the sense of well-being becomes more stable, more enduring, and can withstand greater forces of stress in our life. And it's very tangibly and immediately and obviously rewarding. But that's not the goal. That's not what we're practicing for. It is a byproduct of practice. You can't help but feel a greater sense of well-being as you get a handle on that which is causing you stress and distress and learning how to work with it. But that's a far cry from liberation. And the goal of the Buddha's teaching in path is liberation from all forms of suffering. I want to speak a little bit more about that tomorrow so that we can really clearly see what of our aspiration is kind of psychological, limited to this lifetime's kind of being happy with ourselves, and how much of our practice and aspiration is really with an eye to something that is beyond that. And one way to talk about that just generally is that we talk a lot about the defilements, or I do, I do. And those of you who practice with me know I talk a lot about dukkha and the defilements. But there's a reason. It's because they are the source of suffering. And the lens through which the Buddha looked at life and the activities of life and what we do and what practice is his lens was, does this lead to suffering, or does this lead to the end of suffering? And while there are many different spectrums that we could evaluate events in our life on, that was his. And it was a kind of a very simple, very limited, but a very profound spectrum. And if you take that spectrum in your own life and just ask yourself, of the things that you do and the things that you say and the things that you believe, does this lead to suffering for myself or others, or does this lead to the end of suffering for myself and or others? You might be surprised at how different your life would have to be if you actually chose to not suffer. For example, you get in a snit with your partner, who it's most easy to get into a snit with, or you get into a little difference of opinion about something, and rather than let go of your opinion and how you think it should be, you'd rather stay in conflict and suffer, wanting to be right instead of letting go of just an opinion. Now, I'm not the only person that does that, am I? And more than once, I see, I choose to be right. And as a result of that, I am choosing to suffer. And it just goes to show how very difficult it is to let go of that which causes suffering. It is, even though we know we're suffering, and we know what's causing the suffering, we still can't let go. Sometimes we can, but sometimes we can't. And that's the challenge. That's what is it going to take for us to consistently choose to not suffer? You don't have to say that they're right. You just have to choose not to suffer. That's the path ahead. It's all about learning how to let go. And some of letting go can be done through intention. You notice something and you choose not to do that, you let go. I've told this story before, but it's such a... I'd like to tell the story, so I'm going to tell it again. I can't let go of it. When I went to university, I was studying engineering, and this was back in the day before we even had handheld calculators, and it was all done with a slide rule and a lot of mathematics that was done in the head. A lot of multiplying, a lot of dividing, a lot of mathematics. And so I had a lot of training, and my mind had a lot of conditioning to do mathematical computations. So some years after college, when I was no longer an engineer in engineering, and I started meditating and watching my mind, when my mind wandered, it wandered off into doing mathematical computations. And I'd be meditating, trying to be present with the breath, and I would come to kind of like multiplying out these fantastic 4 or 5 digit numbers in my mind, see if I could hold it all in my mind while I came up with the right answer. And I would notice that I was doing this, and I'd say, do I have to be doing this right now? No. Oh, what a relief. And we can see how letting go brings immediate relief. But in order to let go, you have to know what you're holding on to. I didn't even know that I was hanging on to this habit. Well, so much of our initial discovery in practice is discovering these habits of mind that we don't even know we're doing. And they're strong. They're deeply conditioned. The longer you've lived, you young people are really lucky. You don't have so many years of habit to kind of overcome. We older people have stronger habits, and it's just that much more difficult to see them. And as I said, sometimes just seeing them, we can have the intention to let them go, and poof, gone, instant relief. On the other hand, sometimes we're practicing, we find ourselves in some obsessive thinking pattern or some emotional drama, and we become aware of it, and we say, do I have to be reliving this now? No. Well, let go. Can't. And we're caught in this emotional drama, we're caught in this compulsive, obsessive thinking, addictive pattern of thinking, and even though we recognize the suffering, we would like to let go, that kind of letting go is not possible through mere intention. You can say, let go, and the mind just doesn't. That quality of hanging on, or that degree of hanging on, or that kind of hanging on, entanglement in the mind, can only be let go of by training the mind. Intention doesn't cut it. When I say training the mind, I mean training the mind to be mindful. Because as you become aware of that entanglement, that emotional drama, or that repetitive thinking, or what it is, and you become aware of it, and you're aware of it, and you're aware of it, and you're aware of it, again and again, moment to moment to moment, when it arises, again and again, every time it arises, you begin to not feed it unconsciously, and you begin to kind of temporarily tame it. We say we arrest that the suffering of that entanglement by the continuity of awareness. And Paulette was this morning saying when she sees a defilement in the mind or some flurry of attached suffering in the mind, and she sees it, she can cut it off, go back to a chosen object like the breath or something else. This is one way of learning how to let go through the development of, well, in this case, it's called samadhi, which is the continuity of awareness that is so strong that you can direct it to say, don't go there, go here, and it will. Boom. And so you are able to leave that obsessing mind by the power of your concentration to go and stay direct and keep your mind on what you choose. That is a form of letting go that occurs through the development of samadhi, or the continuity of awareness. Nevertheless, sometimes the conditions that are prevailing or arising in your life are so strong or so commanding that your samadhi or your mindfulness cannot, you cannot leave it and go back to a non-defiled object. And for this we need a more refined and a more powerful practice, and that is the practice of insight. Because intention, you remember I was talking about intention, is a purification of the speech and behavior so that you're not acting out your defilements. Samadhi is a purification of the mind, meaning you purify the mind momentarily of the defilement by being able to direct your mind away from it. But the third kind of defilement is a defilement that arises because we understand things wrongly. We see what's going on, we have a wrong understanding of it. I've mentioned today that the tendency of the mind to take a momentary experience of impatience or desire or anger, take a momentary experience of that and identify that as who I am, how I am. We constellate a sense of self around it, when in fact there's no self there. But we identify it as who I am. That's a wrong understanding. But that understanding that this body and this mind is really not me, that understanding is not easy to remove from the mind. Think about it. We believe, most of us believe strongly, this body is my body, this mind is my mind. Together, they're who I am. We believe that. Everything in our experience points to that being true. The Buddha said, that is a wrong understanding. How in the world are we ever going to let go of that wrong understanding? Well, just as Dale suggested this morning, when you see the body and the mind, rather than cut it off, or see a defiled mind, rather than cut it off and go back to a chosen object, you watch. You observe. You pay attention to it and see how it works. You see, how is it really, this body and this mind? Is it mine? Can I control it? Is it who I am? Is there something else going on here? And gradually, as we just pay attention to the arising and passing away of stuff, mental, physical, environmental stuff, we begin to get it that everything is impermanent. Everything is impersonal. There's nothing that we experience that is going to provide this lasting satisfaction and security that we all seek. But those understandings are subtle, and they're difficult to access and to mature so that they offer an alternate view of this body and mind. But that's the path we're on, to liberate the mind from wrongly understanding this mind-body process. So when I say, what is your aspiration? Or ask you to consider what your aspiration is. I certainly didn't have the aspiration to liberate the mind from wrong understanding when I started practice. It's almost impossible to have that. We don't even know what that means. You know, and we come to practice with some, you know, I just want to get a handle on my stress, you know, or I want to explore, you know, the dimensions of the mind, or, you know, I want to develop love, or I got to get a handle on my anger, or whatever. We have different ways of articulating what we think we need and what we think the practice can offer. If you keep practicing, if that's enough to get you to practice, practice will take you from there. But you have to practice. You actually have to do the work. And if you do, it will clarify for you what is possible and what the path really is. The path only appears as you keep walking it. You can't know the end of the path before you get there. All you can do is hope and pray that you stumble on the path somewhere. And when you do, take the next step, because that will reveal the next step and the next step and the next step. And in time, we grow into understanding that, oh, this path leads to liberation. Liberation from wrongly understanding this package called me. Sometimes it seems just immense. The journey of awakening just seems so daunting and so comprehensive that we can doubt that it's possible for me or in this lifetime or however. We can just doubt that it's possible. And as a corollary of the practice of insight, or the practice of samadhi and insight, which lead to that liberation, we work with the defilements in many, many different ways. Some of which leads to understanding, some of which leads to restraint, some of which leads to just don't go there, you know, don't do it. Or, yeah, it's the anti-Nike practice. Just don't do it. You know. But there's also the positive corollaries, the proactive development of the qualities of the awakened mind by undertaking what are called the parami practices. And the paramis are those qualities of mind that get developed through liberating practice and come to the foreground, if you will, in awakening. Qualities like truthfulness, energy, renunciation, resoluteness of mind, wisdom, loving kindness, patience, generosity, harmony, and there's one more. I can never remember that one. I had that one. Morality, I had that one. But these are practices to develop wholesome qualities of mind, the antidotes to the defilements of mind. And so as we practice these paramis, we develop the qualities of mind that support awakening. We can also become very attached to our spiritual self who's developing these qualities. So, you know, there's a sutra discourse that the Buddha gave where he talks about the black karma, the white karma, and the karma that's neither black nor white. The black karma is acting out your defilements. It's leading into darkness of mind and suffering. The white karma is the karma of good intentions without necessarily wisdom. And so we do things, you know, taking pride in it and getting developing a sense of self that we then get attached to. The karma that is neither white nor black is the practice of the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. To the extent that you practice right view, right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right concentration, these are actions which are not unwholesome or wholesome. They are actions which lead to the end of karma. This is liberation. So, where am I going with all this? I'm going to 4:30. All of the effort that you've made today to be mindful, right mindfulness, To be continuous, right concentration. To get here, right intention. To try to understand what's going on, right understanding. To speak carefully about your practice, right speech. To live in harmony with one another, right action. All of these, this is, has been a day of developing those qualities of mind and actions which lead to liberation. Not easy, but this is the kind of a practice which ultimately, if developed, fully developed, leads to, well, I would say, the highest aspiration. You don't have to have that aspiration yet, and it would be premature to kind of pretend that that's your aspiration, but know that if you continue to do this practice, it will become your aspiration.